So we have a family that's been acquiring wealth, that's been acquiring social prestige, that's been acquiring influence, that's been acquiring political power, that's been acquiring military power for a long time. The situation seems anomalous, does it not? But the Carolingians were also, in a way, sticklers for legitimacy. Now, it's true that in 751, they take over the throne. And it's true that, strictly speaking, they were usurpers. But Pippin III, who reigned from 751 till 768, sent a delegation to Rome to Pope Zachary in about the year 749, maybe 750. And he asked the Pope, was it right that the person in the Frankish world who had the title of the king possessed no power, but the person who possessed power lacked the title of king? The Pope wrote back a very interesting letter, which echoes some sentiments from the 19th book of St. Augustine's City of God, and said, this is a contravention of order. This is not the way the world is supposed to be. Things are supposed to be, in a sense, as they are named. This was clearly a signal. Pippin, you should be the king. Now, why would Zachary have done this? First of all, it may very well have been that from a theological point of view, he genuinely believed this to be the case. From another point of view, he was being pressed closely by the Lombards in Italy. He needed help, and he had no place else to turn. He couldn't turn to Constantinople. The authorities at Constantinople were tied down in the Balkans, were tied down fighting Muslims in the east. They had no interest in coming to save the Pope from Lombards in Italy. Now, Pippin had almost certainly prepared his usurpation very carefully with the Frankish elites. In other words, we can't really imagine an historical situation where Pippin sent his delegation down to Rome to ask Zachary the famous question, you know, is this situation in the Frankish world right? And Zachary said, well, yeah, I don't have any problem with that. Sounds fine to me. I mean, we can't imagine that outcome. Pippin had prepared this very carefully indeed. But what he needed was an additional kind of legitimacy, an additional kind of legitimation. He wanted to be something more than a mere usurper, someone who had taken his throne by main force. Well, he took his throne, you see, because the vicar of God on earth, the Pope, the chief priest of the church, had, in a sense, provided the theological warrant for doing so. Now, Pippin ruled on and ruled very effectively for 17 years. He began rebuilding the prestige of the monarchy. He began rebuilding central institutions of the Frankish state, which in some respects had dissipated under the last Merovingian kings. It's worth remembering that these Carolingians, as mayors of the palace, had been in charge over all these decades. So things had never collapsed too badly, but the Carolingians are now able to operate in their own name, whereas previously they'd been operating in the name of the reigning, if not ruling, king. When Pippin died in 768, he left two sons, Charles and Carloman. Within 3 years, Carloman was dead. Charles, on the other hand, is a very different story. He reigned over the Franks from 768 until 814. His reign marks a turning point in European history. He was a very large man, perhaps 6'3", 6'4". He was striking to his contemporaries. We have a number of contemporary descriptions of him. We have no strictly contemporary portrait of him. We have some sculpture from the middle of the 9th century that may provide a reasonable likeness, we think, but we have nothing that we can be confident is a contemporary portrait of the man. We have our literary portraits, and they show us a very complex figure. A man who was deeply moral and yet profligate, we might say. He was married 4 times. His wives died under unsuspicious circumstances. But he had a number of concubines. He produced several legitimate children, but perhaps as many as 20 altogether, more than half of which were not legitimate. He was a man who could be deeply kind, deeply humane, who could be moved by human suffering, who could be moved by the circumstances of his own family, but who could also be positively vicious when crossed by someone or when crossed by enemies. There is a story told of him that he slaughtered 4,500 Saxons on one day simply to teach them a lesson. It isn't absolutely clear that he did that, and the number 4,500 is suspiciously round, but there was certainly something that happened on that day that was widely remembered. He was, in many ways, a barbarous man, and yet at the same time, a learned man. We're told, for example, that he was perfectly fluent in his native Germanic tongue, that he could both speak and understand Latin, and that he could understand Greek, though not speak it very well. We know that he could read. We are told that Augustine's City of God was his favorite book. Yet we know that he couldn't write. As an old man, he was trying to teach himself how to write, and he couldn't get on with it very well. Said perhaps he just had begun learning a bit too late.